Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett. Tonight on PBS News Weekend, after the storm, we get the latest on the ground in Florida, where people in the path of Hurricane Ian are putting their homes and lives back together. Then, the Revolution Generation. We look at how the protests in Iran over the killing of a woman in police custody are being driven by Gen Z.
Today, men and women in Iran are united in wanting to destroy the Islamic Republic forever.
And a grand adventure. We talked to a grandmother and grandson about their goal of visiting every national park in the U.S. Those stories and the day's headlines on tonight's PBS News Weekend. Good evening. It's great to be with you. Tonight, the remnants of Hurricane Ian are making their way inland across North Carolina and Virginia. In the wake of this massive storm, at least 30 people are confirmed dead, mostly in Florida, and that number is expected to increase. Damage estimates are also growing, and Ian is thought to be one of the costliest storms in U.S. history. John Yang has this report from Florida.
People ventured back to Fort Myers any way they could, by kayak, by bicycle, and gingerly by foot over widespread wreckage. The city is barely recognizable after being pummeled by Ian in a near direct hit.
I was stuck in that tree.
Tammy Clementine rode out the storm by clinging to her roof. She lost everything except her dogs.
It was scary as hell. It was like Twister. It was scary. I mean, everything was just falling in my house. Refrigerator, TVs, all brand new stuff. Brand new living rooms, I just got it. No insurance.
The sheer power of the storm slammed a large boat into this Fort Myers apartment complex. 25-year-old Anthony Rivera helped his loved ones to safety.
To see a boat literally right next to my apartment as I'm trying to pull my grandmother and my girlfriend out, that's the scariest thing in the world. Because I can't stop no boat. You know, I'm not Superman.
79-year-old Stevie Scuderi had to swim to an empty second-floor unit for safety. Her apartment is ruined.
I just told myself I feel like I want to sit in the corner and cry. I don't know what else to do. I just don't know.
Over Sanibel Island, the U.S. Coast Guard has been on search and rescue missions, hoisting people to safety from the waterlogged island, which is completely cut off.
How deep is this now?
Oh, this is at least two and a half feet. And it gets deeper as we go that way.
Scott Thinnes lives in Venice, where the initial storm flooding had receded. But now, new flooding from the overwhelmed Mayaca River is taking over. He took us to his house by boat. This morning, the river was at a record 12.73 feet, 2 feet above major flood stage, and still rising. Neighbor Alan Pomerlo and his daughter Carly stood in waist-deep water helping Scott and his wife Shannon.
We renovated in 2014, and we put things in the house to be much higher than the highest flood we've ever had so that we could sustain things like this without any damage. And it's gone over our hot water heater, our water system, all of our plugs. So everything that we had done to accommodate the river, it's just a record high. So we've gone underwater.
It's not just humans who are suffering in Ian's wake. Animals have paid a price, too. At the Wildlife Center of Southwest Florida in Venice, they rescue and rehabilitate animals native to the state. Pamela Defau is the executive director.
We've seen a lot of birds of prey with fractured wings, and a lot of that has to do with the obvious high rate of wind that came through, knocking them out of trees. The same with the squirrels. You know, they blow out of their nest and then they're laying on the ground for 10 to 12 hours, you know, because the storm was so long.
And the far-reaching effects of Ian aren't over. The storm continued its march up the East Coast, hitting the Carolinas with rains and high winds. The storm surge knocked out piers along the coast. In Florida this afternoon, FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell acknowledged the long road to recovery.
We have already started the planning efforts for what it's going to take to rebuild these communities and recover from this storm, but also recover in a way that makes them more resilient against some of the impacts from these storms in the future.
This was scary. It was my first ever hurricane experience. It was scary. I just hope it gets better.
But for many in Southwest Florida and beyond, full recovery is still weeks, if not months, away.
Another distinctive feature about this storm, officials say it caused more water damage than wind damage here in Florida. And as you can see, the sun and the sun seekers have returned to the beaches of southwestern Florida. But in the days ahead, there is a lot of hard work for a lot of people. Jeff?
And John, what do we know about the cost of recovery in Florida and elsewhere resulting from Hurricane Ian?
There are some estimates that this could be the most costliest storm in U.S. history. By one estimate, up to $100 billion, billion with a B. But a lot of this stuff can't be quantified. I think back to the people we met earlier today in Venice, Florida, having to use boats to get in and out of their neighborhood, which is totally inundated by several feet of water, several feet of standing water in their homes, their mailboxes underwater. True, none of them lost roofs, none of them lost a wall, and thank goodness none of them lost their lives, but they do have water just sitting in their homes. Furniture and carpeting can be replaced, but some may have lost family mementos, and you can't put a price tag on that. Jeff?
That's true. John Yang reporting for us tonight from Siesta Key, just outside Sarasota, Florida. John, our thanks to you. In today's other headlines, Russian forces are retreating from the city of Liman to avoid being encircled by Ukraine's army. The city is in the eastern Donetsk region of Ukraine and is considered a strategic transportation hub. Ukrainian forces could be seen today raising their flag over the city. Russia's withdrawal comes just a day after Russian President Vladimir Putin illegally declared Donetsk and three other regions as part of Russia. Ukraine is accusing Russia of attacking civilians in the northeast who were trying to evacuate today. 20 people are dead, including children. Just yesterday, 30 more civilians were killed in a Russian missile attack in Zaporizhia. Russia also detained the head of the nuclear power plant there, saying he's being, quote, held for questioning. The plant is the largest in Europe and has been under Russian control for months. The Biden administration secured a rare prisoner swap today, freeing seven Americans who were imprisoned in Venezuela. The swap includes five American oil executives who were among the so-called Citgo Six, held hostage in Venezuela for nearly 5 years. In exchange, the U.S. will release two nephews of President Nicolas Maduro's wife, who had been jailed in the U.S. on drug smuggling convictions. It marks the largest trade of detained citizens during the Biden administration. And a somber anniversary of note. 5 years ago today, a lone gunman in a Las Vegas hotel opened fire on a crowd of tens of thousands attending a country music festival. 60 Americans were killed. Hundreds more were injured. President Biden, in a statement today, said that he and the First Lady, quote, mourn with all those who lost a piece of their soul on that day. The massacre remains the deadliest mass shooting in modern U.S. history. And former President Jimmy Carter, the oldest living U.S. president, turns 98 today. A spokesperson says President Carter will celebrate quietly at home today with his family and watch his favorite Major League Baseball team, the Atlanta Braves, on television. Happy birthday to him. And still to come on PBS News Weekend, how Gen Z helped ignite the ongoing protests in Iran. And a grandmother and grandson take on the national parks.
This is PBS News Weekend from WETA Studios in Washington, home of the PBS NewsHour, weeknights on PBS.
We're going to take a look now at the financial markets. The third quarter has come to an end, and many investors are wishing it good riddance. The Dow Jones Industrial Average saw its worst September since 2002 and its worst monthly drop since March 2020. And the S&P 500 and NASDAQ are on track to experience their first three-quarter losing streaks since 2009. Here to help us make sense of the markets is Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure podcast. Robin, it's great to have you with us. And look, around the world, you've got markets reeling. The values of currencies are plunging. Oil and other commodities are getting hammered. What is happening?
Everything, Jeff, is ultimately hardwired to the United States' main interest rate that the Federal Reserve controls. And we've gotten used over decades to just really low interest rate policy. In times of crisis, indeed, we take interest rates to zero. And it's a free-for-all for real estate and risk asset holders and stocks and NFTs and crypto. The problem this time is there's this broadening idea that the Fed doesn't have a handle on inflation. Hmm. And it could be so out of its control that it has to keep hiking rates. And so no one knows. They're kind of selling first and asking questions later, whether you talk about the Brits, asset markets across the world, emerging markets, corporate debt, junk bonds in the United States. It's really such an overdue reckoning. And people for years have been saying the 40-year bull market in bonds is over, the 30-year bull market in bonds is over. And there's this idea right now that it's finally caught up to us.
And there have been few places for investors to hide because, as you mentioned, there's so much volatility in the bond market. I mean, what are some of the best practices? What are people supposed to do?
That's the consternation in this. We called my episode this week Bondsternation because typically bonds provide ballast in a portfolio. If you see in 2008 or 2011 at other times when people are selling, they pour into the readout of safety that is the U.S. Treasury market. What's unusual this time is the diversified portfolio is getting hit kind of equal opportunity victims this year, bonds and stocks, because of inflation. And inflation is such a wily foe. It's one that we really haven't had to deal with in robust terms since the early 80s. So whether you talk about gold, oil, they're open to the vicissitudes of so many other things that there isn't a place to kind of hide out. I ask people, like, is it Haas avocados, Peruvian alpacas? Like, what is going to hold its value? And that's the question, the multi-trillion dollar question right now.
Well, look, Robin, you spoke to this. I mean, there seems to be global agreement about who is causing all of this volatility. The central banks, with the Federal Reserve in the lead. I was going to ask you if this is all part of the Fed's plan, but based on what you said earlier, it seems like it's not.
Here's one of the things that the Fed can't come out and say. Jerome Powell, the Fed chair, cannot jawbone housing prices and tell you people, you guys, you're ridiculous. 25% in 2 years, get out of here. He can't jawbone NFTs and other things. He has a blunt instrument of hiking rates by chunky terms. 0.75 point, 0.75 point, 0.75 point. When does that end? What that does is I think the ulterior motive, and actually one of the main motives is to soften the labor market. He actually does want higher unemployment for more slack for wages to come down. He wants to see asset prices get a haircut. He wants to see real estate take a haircut. And indeed, we saw mortgage rates this year touch a 15-year high. They're near 7%. You can buy a lot more house with a 3% mortgage than you can a 7% mortgage.
Are there any winners in this brutal bear market?
Gosh, what is defensive out there? The time was you could go and look at Campbell's Soup or a pickle company or something that was stayed. But I've looked all across. I mean, grocery companies are getting hit because, again, we don't have an institutional memory of pernicious, persistent inflation. It's something that I often say my dad talks to me about when I was a little kid. And he'd show me the passbook savings accounts and he'd tell me about the price of milk. But in our adulthood, Jeff, you know, in my investing lifetime, we really haven't had to deal with inflation.
Robin, for people who don't study the markets as closely as you do, but who really only see their retirement accounts plummeting, is a bear market the same as being on the precipice of a recession, or are those two sort of different things?
They don't necessarily go into lockstep. We've had so many bear markets, just even since the crash of 87 or the early 80s. As a part of a broader kind of broad increase in the S&P 500 and the Dow. But bear markets hurt. You don't want to log into the 401k or the Roth IRA and see that it's taken a 25% haircut. But to answer another question, Jeff, there is a silver lining. You can finally get yield. You know, let's not underestimate this. With inflation up there, it's keeping the fixed income markets and the dividend markets a little more honest. You could get something like a 3.5% a yield on a shorter term treasury or a 10-year treasury. Certificates of deposits, the banks finally have to pay up after a long period of not giving you anything. So there is real yield out there, but it's coldly comforting at a time when we don't know if the Fed's going to have to stop at 5%, at 6%, at 7%. What is the cry uncle point? And so again, everyone is selling first and asking questions later.
Robin Farzad, host of the Full Disclosure podcast. Thanks as always for your insights, friend.
My pleasure. Thank you, Jeff.
The The Islamic Republic of Iran is no stranger to popular uprisings. The regime cracked down on protests in 2009 and again 10 years later. But the demonstrations sweeping the country today are different. They're being led by young people and are playing out both in the streets and online.
After 2 weeks of protests and brutal government backlash, Iranian activists, predominantly young women, remain defiant. The protests started earlier this year over high prices, but erupted in mid-September after the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini. She died in police custody after being arrested by Iran's morality police, who said she was wearing her hijab improperly. Since demonstrations began, more than 80 people have been killed.
Down with terrorist regime of Iran.
And protests have spread to other countries, from the U.S. to Turkey, where an Iranian woman cut her hair, a popular act of resistance.
Today, men and women in Iran are united in wanting to destroy the Islamic Republic forever. When women are liberated, then the whole society will be liberated.
Hello, TikTok. This is me talking from Iran.
But with social media the preferred battlefield for this generation of protesters, even those Iranian women staying inside are finding ways to speak out.
To help us better understand Iran's Gen Z protesters, I'm joined by Holly Dagres. She's a fellow with the Atlantic Council, a Washington-based think tank, where she is also the editor of the Iran Source blog. Holly, thank you for joining us. You've previously said that the 2009 Green Revolution, which was kind of called the social media revolution in Iran, is not really the best example of how social media revolutions in Iran can go, and that this one actually is much more deserving of that moniker. Why is that, and who are these protesters?
Well, these protesters are led by Iranian Gen Z with women at the forefront. And what's been key here is that Iranian Gen Z, like Gen Z everywhere, is online. They're on social media, they're on TikTok, Instagram, and they use social media to express themselves and for their voices to be heard. And we've seen they've even used social media as a form of expressing themselves through lyric. Shervin Hajipour, a singer that's based in Iran, actually used the tweets from actual Iranians as part of his lyrics. And some of the needs and wants included the ability to kiss their lover in the streets, to dance in the streets, and for freedom. And unfortunately, Shervin Hajipour was arrested by security forces.
And security forces are indeed cracking down very hard. They're using different censorship means to prevent Iranians from getting those messages out. Is that going to be something that impedes these protesters' progress or the ability to achieve their goals? Or are they finding ways around the regime's crackdowns?
Well, since the 2009 post-election protests known as the Green Movement, the Islamic Republic has viewed internet and social media as a national security threat. So they've been cracking down hard on the internet over the years. And so with much of the world's most popular websites, 35% of the world's websites have been blocked by Iran. And Iranians use circumvention tools like virtual private networks to get by. Right now, we've been hearing from Iranians on the ground. They have to go through dozens of VPNs in order to get these messages out to the world.
It's truly incredible when you think of the efforts that they have to go to. I want to ask you also about the age difference between the regime, the clerics who run it, and these protesters. How is that generational gap playing into what we're seeing on the ground?
Well, Iranian Gen Z is under the age of 25. Much of the clerical establishment at the top are geriatric, in their own words, of Gen Z. They have nothing really in common with them. A lot of Gen Z, because they spend time online, do a lot of the same things that Gen Zers in the West do. They make deep fakes, they make memes. And so, for example, there's ageism memes about this cleric by the name of Ayatollah Janati. And Ayatollah Janati is 95 years old. He's the chairman of the Influential Guardian Council, which is a vetting body. And they actually refer to him as a dinosaur and a T-Rex. And so they actually show this in memes that they make. And that should just give you a sense of how disconnected they are with the government in the Islamic Republic.
Finally, Holly, I want to get your sense of what the Biden administration is doing. How do you think that they've responded to these protests so far?
Well, they've been a little behind, but they finally caught up in May. It took a while for the Biden administration to react to protests back then. It took about 9 days for the U.S. State Department spokesperson, Ned Price, to actually issue a statement. Meanwhile, the State Department's Persian language Instagram account was posting about SoulCycle and CrossFit. And so they've definitely did a 180. We've now heard condemnation from all levels of government, and that's been very important. We've also seen that they've issued a general license that would be important for internet freedom. And that was something that has been called for years, even since the Trump administration. And now we're finally seeing that done. Whether it's going to really help with things on the ground, that's the question.
Holly Dagres with the Atlantic Council, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Ninety-two-year-old Joy Ryan and her grandson Brad Ryan have spent the past 7 years crisscrossing the U.S. with the goal of visiting every national park. Grandma Joy's road trip, as they call it on social media, began after Brad found out his grandmother had never seen a mountain before. And that started them on a trip of a lifetime. Joy and Brad Ryan join us now. It's great to see you both.
Thank you.
Great to see you.
And Brad, you had the idea for this quest back in October 2015, and ever since then, you both have been steadily chipping away, visiting every one of the 63 national parks. What prompted this idea?
I think there's just, this innate desire that I had to make sure that the sunset of her life was filled with as many memories as we could pack in. And because she had a willing spirit and she showed that she still had a lot of adventure left to live, when we went on that first trip by climbing mountains with me and camping and doing all the things that blew me away, I didn't see any reason to stop.
And Mrs. Ryan, when your grandson suggested the idea for this trip, how did you react? What was your response?
I said, yeah, I was ready to go.
Yeah. Did you know it would involve camping outside and kayaking and rafting and mountain climbing and the whole thing?
Yeah, but I'm willing to try anything once. Yeah.
You know, we didn't know what we were getting into until we were just thrown into it. We arrived at the Elkmont campground in the Smokies at like 1 or 2 in the morning, and it was pouring down rain. We ate a lot of ramen noodles on a budget when we did our 28-day camping trip around the lower 48 for the first time, but it was nothing but joyful, honestly.
And Brad, how has this changed your relationship, this traveling together?
I always tell folks, I think every family has some good and bad in it. And it's really helpful and healing to be able to work all of that out through conversation. Everything kind of comes to the surface eventually, and you just work it out. And at the end of the day, nature is kind of that equalizer.
Mrs. Ryan, of the 62 national parks that you've visited so far, what's been your favorite?
It's all just to pick one, but I had never seen a whale in my whole life except on a picture. And when we went out to the islands in California, one jumped up right in front of me, and it was miraculous. It really was.
I also saw a picture of you, I think it was in Alaska. You were in a helicopter, and you could just see glaciers off, in the distance.
Yeah, it was an exciting trip, I can tell you that. But we had a good time, and thank heaven the pilot knew what he was doing.
Mrs. Ryan, how has all of this traveling changed your perspective? How has it changed you as a person?
Well, I've lived in the same district, in the same house for 67 years, and it's just hard to imagine all the beautiful, wonderful things that you find outside. And it's just made, it's just been miraculous. And I've enjoyed every minute of it. And it'll give me something when I get old that I can sit and talk about.
Yes, ma'am. Well, it is, it's been a real joy to speak with you both. I wish you all the best. And after your trip to the American Samoa, I hope you'll come back and tell us all about it.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
And that is our program for tonight. I'm Jeff Bennett. For all of us at PBS News Weekend, thanks for spending part of your Saturday with us.